Okay. As any Buddhist knows, Buddhism is plagued with bad translation. For instance, the Four Noble Truths. The word dukkha is often and always translated as suffering. Doesn't mean suffering. It means a lot of things, but not suffering. Mainly what it means is, if we look into the etymology of the word, it means contemptible emptiness. Like there's this gigantic hole here that we can't fill and we keep putting stuff into it, and it never gets filled because as soon as we put stuff into it, the stuff goes away. But there are many, many other applications of the word. This is another word, dhyani, which was poorly translated back in the 1880s. It really means one who meditates. Unfortunately, it was translated as wisdom Buddhas, the five wisdom Buddhas. Very early on, as soon as somebody discovered Tibet, they started mistranslating. Tibetan is also plagued with poor translation. But these five Buddhas, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, represent five separate aspects of wisdom, and they are archetypes for what was extraordinarily important in India and later in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, and finally all over Asia, wherever Vajrayana was practiced. The archetype is that of the enlightened being, the sage, the one who experiences reality. And it's kind of interesting because they mix that archetype up with other archetypes to come up with a family of Buddhas. And these represent five of those families, the five families. Originally, the practice involved 35 Buddhas, seven of each color. But the names were unpronounceable. The practice of the 35 Buddhas was so intricate, you needed a week-long retreat. So popularity died off, and we're left with the five, which made it a lot simpler. Before I go on, I have to explain that name. Venerable indicates a ordained monk, and it refers to, or priest, depending if you're in a temple or a monastery. It's what we use for the word reverend. Doctor, because I do have a doctorate in Buddhist studies. Acharya is a popular way, the Japanese is ajari, but it's a popular way of saying teacher. And in this case, it refers to a Vajrayana or a tantric teacher, because that's what Tendai does. Shaku means a disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha. Mui is my name. Shinshi left his heart in reality, which is an aspiration, not a fact. And everybody calls me Sensei Mui, because that too, that name is also very long, very drawn out, very complicated, and very difficult to spell. Okay, dhyana. Ultimately, it comes from the Pali word, jhani, which means one who meditates. In Sanskrit, that same word is pronounced dhyani. And in Chinese, it's pronounced chana. And you probably know it as zen. It's the same word, just transliterated into different languages. So, for a Japanese person, that would read dhyani or zenna, one who meditates or one who does zen. The practice was originally called yoga vachara in Pali. The practice is very, very old. It dates back to about the 3rd century Common Era, which is about 300 years before, maybe 400 years before Vajrayana actually was formulated. In 1828, there was a reform movement in Southeast Asia amongst the Theravadan schools, and Yoga Vachara went underground, and it's starting to make a comeback again in certain cults of Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. Okay, in Buddhism, anyone who meditates is called a yogi. Because yoga, which, although it means to, means yoke, actually. Yoke is you take two oxes and put a yoke on them and you plow. Anybody old enough to remember that? Okay. Anyway, so it means to bind together. And the term yogi is still used in Buddhism for one who meditates and has a practice, because that's how the word is used, as practice. And that's how the word was actually used in Hinduism and whatever preceded Hinduism. Yogi is the guy, yogini is the girl, and the Siddhartha Gautama was called a yogi in several pieces of literature amongst the Jainist schools. Okay, not all schools of Buddhism meditate or even recognize the five dhyana, wisdom Buddhas. Some schools recognize one or two, but not all five. One school of Buddhism actually adds a sixth Buddha called Adi Buddha. And this is a Tibetan form, again, leave it to the Tibetans. They created a Buddha which is the primordial Buddha from whom all other Buddhas emanate, and he is a first cause for enlightenment, which is kind of interesting since the historical Buddha and most of the Buddhist literature that I have read, like the entire Pali Canon and half of the Mahayana Canon, denies a first cause for anything. Things just seem to be going on infinitely in both directions, which is also a misnomer, because things don't happen linearly in Buddhism. Things happen very, very chaotically. We invented the chaos theory, especially when it comes to the discussions of karma. And one school rejects all of them, and that would be, of course, be Theravada does not do a whole lot of work with them. And officially, it's not that they reject them, they just don't talk about them. Okay, typically in Buddhism, there are three or four major schools of Buddhism. They're called yanas, or paths. You have Theravada, which is based on the original texts found in the Pali Canon. You have Mahayana, which is called the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. Vajrayana, which is the third turning of the wheel of Dharma. Buddha's arm was getting very, very tired by the time he got to this one, turning that wheel a lot. Anyway, so, and Zen. And Zen is often considered to be its own school. It prefers to see itself as a Mahayana tradition. Vajrayana prefers to see itself as a subset of the Mahayana tradition. The Mahayana scriptures were actually written about the first century before the Common Era. That's when they started writing the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and then it came, which mentions some of these Buddhas that we'll be talking about, but certainly not all. And then Vajrayana, which appears around the 6th or 7th century Common Era, a little over 1,000 years after the Parinibbana of the Buddha, comes Vajrayana. They like to claim that it was 16 years after the Buddha started teaching that he taught Vajrayana. And there's no scholar in the world that is going to buy that, because the word didn't even exist until the mid-8th century. And to a certain extent, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and Zen represent synthetic schools of Buddhism. They're hybrids. They synthesized local indigenous practices with the doctrine of the Buddha. They're not going to disagree with the Pali Canon, but the way they express that Pali Canon, or the teachings found in the Pali Canon, in their own lives, will draw from locals. I once had a sangha when I lived in Washington State. I once had a sangha that of Native Americans, Yakima Indian tribe. They practiced Buddhism, but they used their native forms. Is that a kind of Vajrayana? Could be. Could be. Anyway, I wasn't going to talk them out of it. There were 400 of them and only one of me. Okay, so, and all authorities agree that the Theravada, probably the closest to what the Buddha actually taught, but not everybody agrees on the rest of the schools. As a matter of fact, recently there was a big debate, I think it's since died out, of whether or not Zen itself represented a Buddhist form. So Buddha started out with a very, very simple, direct, forward idea, where we have complicated it into an incomprehensible mass of ideas and practices, which is probably pretty good when you stop and think. If there were 300 billion Buddhists in the world, there would be 300 billion paths to enlightenment. Each one has his own jnana. The practice is so individualized that one size just doesn't fit all. You have to start from where you're at. Okay. What is meant by Buddha depends on with whom you speak. Yeah, that was right. With whom you speak. If you ask a Nikaya purist, one who just goes by the original four books, when you say Buddha, he's thinking Siddhartha Gautama. Nothing else. If you ask a Mahayana person, what is Buddha? He will tell you it's a state of mind. If you asked a Vajrayana person, he will say it is a state of mind based upon the pure stream of consciousness. Three different definitions, same word. So we have to be a little careful on how we, who we're talking to, on how we use that word. If we're talking about, let's go back up. If we're talking about these five guys, they resemble Shakyamuni Buddha in form, but not in color. They don't represent him in name, but they are representative of what he did. And this is the important thing about these five Buddhas. They represent a way to enlightenment. Now, each deity, they're called deities. Like I said, we're playing with terrible translation. Has a different color. This one's white, but it doesn't show up on board, so I made him black. Vairochana is the first. He's the central figure. And please notice we have the deity. He confronts a particular kind of delusion, and he represents a particular type or category of enlightened mind. Actually, I think that's supposed to be pronounced Vairochana, but Vairochana is what we call him in the States. The delusion he attacks is ignorance, and ignorance in this case does not mean stupidity. It means blindness, that we're not seeing clearly what's right in front of our noses. And we're not seeing reality as it is, but we're seeing reality as we create it. And that is the delusion that he confronts. And his enlightened mind is an all-encompassing Dharma Dhatu wisdom. Dharma Dhatu is the sphere of material reality. Things as they are. Akshobhaya attacks anger and hatred with a mirror-like wisdom. Knowing that the mind only reflects what the mind is projecting. We only see what we project. This is the wisdom of Akshobhaya. Ratnasambhava attacks pride and miserliness with the wisdom of equality. All things are equal. We haven't really, this Vairochana probably deals most with non-duality at this point. The rest of them deal with very strict dualities. Amitabha, who is the most popular form of a Buddha in the world right now, there are a lot of people into this guy, attacks desire and lust with discriminating wisdom. And Amoghasiddhi, jealousy and fear, with all-encompassing wisdom. Okay. They each represent elements and spaces, senses, a medical or physical part of the body, and a specific organ. Virochana has to do with space. His sense is sight for clear seeing. He deals with the nadi, the energy channels in the body, and the actual organ is the heart. And you can read the rest here. This one would be air here, and this one would be water. Don't know why they didn't show up. The interesting thing in Ayurvedic medicine, Buddhist forms of Ayurvedic medicine, they actually use meditations for these particular organs, utilizing these particular deities right here. And their names are interesting. Now, this is one of those terrible translations, consort. They're not consorts. The Anglican gentleman that translated these things originally saw that they were called prajna. Prajna is a Sanskrit word for wisdom. And wisdom is always feminine in Buddhism. Compassion always masculine. Go figure. The English gentleman saw pictures of naked ladies on the laps of these Buddhas and said, oh, they must be consorts. They were all Anglican ministers and they had nothing to relate to out of Buddhism, so they translated this thing as consort. Doesn't mean that. They're the wiser aspect of the compassionate male figure. How that arose was that in the old days, way before I was born, fathers used to go out hunt. They used to go out and glean out of the fields, and they were gone all day. The mother, the women, were left at home to teach the children. Hence, they were associated with wisdom. What happens if you're gone on a hunting trip for 4 or 5 days, and you come home, you see your kids, you spoil them rotten. Compassion. That's why male is compassion, female, excuse me, male is compassion, female, left and right, is wisdom. Virochana is nicknamed illuminating in English. His prajna is Vajradavisvari, who is the white Tara in Tibetan. His bodhisattva, his helper, junior partner, is Samantabhadra. And they all turn these different wheels. These are individuals who supposedly physically manifested, that one we know, and Maitreya is yet to come. And they teach. They're the Buddhas of the age. So the historical Buddha in our life, or in our dispensation, is Shakyamuni. As Shobhaya is unshakable, his prajna is Lokana, and we'll be going over these two in particular a little bit later. Vajrapani is his bodhisattva, and that's his Buddha. Ratnasambhava, the jewel-born Mamaki, is his prajna. Amitabha, infinite light. Pandara, and that is the same as Pandora, the one that opened the box in Greek mythology. His helper is Avalokiteshvara, and Shakyamuni is his manifestation. And Amoghasiddhi, the conqueror, green Tara. Notice there are two Taras here. There are actually 27 Taras. Some count 31, but I think it's more like 37. They're all different colors. Some of them have heads, some of them carry their heads. And they represent different aspects of white for wisdom, green for fertility, fruition, making goals happen. So they got the colors, direction, and they all have particular gestures. I hope you can see these. This is the symbol of turning the wheel and teaching, and it's actually kind of cool. It's done sort of like that when you do and teach the wheel, or it can be done like that when you're turning the wheel. The earth-touching, The earth-touching mudra is when the historical Buddha, when asked by Mara, the demon, you know, who's your witness that you're enlightened? Who can I believe since I can't believe you? And the Buddha supposedly reached down, touched the earth like so, and said, the earth is my witness. That's where that expression comes from. The earth is his witness. At that time, the earth shook, deities arose, and Mara had to go away in shame. And okay, they also have directions. One of the Vairochena, being the head deity, is in the center. Ashobhaya is in the east. Ratnasambhava, the gift bestower, is in the south. Why is the gift bestower in the south? Because that's warm, that's where all the crops are at. That's how he got that. And then Amitabha is the one that is in meditation. And he has his own mudra, which is, this is the cosmic mudra. You see this amongst Tibetans and Zen people all the time. It's like this. This one means non-duality. It's called the cosmic mudra. This is the mudra of Amitabha Buddha. Infinite life and infinite light, but also duality, because we live in a dualistic world. There is a this and there's a that. That's our dualism. And Amitabha works specifically with that sort of landscape. And then Amoghasiddhi is green. He's in the north. That's optimism for you. And he has the hand of fearlessness. Whoa. Stop. And what he is fearless about is his own illusions. If an enlightened being can have illusions, when we practice with Amoghasiddhi, we are trying to get rid of the delusions, the fear that we live with, the idea that we can't get comfortable in our own skin. And that's what he talks about. And there's more symbolism. Nothing but symbolism in with these people. Okay, there's Vairochana's wheel. And here, when we get into the symbolism, we get into sound as well. Because sound is very, very, very important in this kind of a practice, because there's mantras involved. So the ever-popular Om is his sound. Whenever we call Om, we are experiencing, according to Vajrayana now, so we are experiencing Vairochena, who exists in all forms. A form is anything we can pick up with our six senses. A touch, a sight, a sound, a taste, a smell, and a thought. Because in Buddhism, even a thought is a sensation. It's a biochemical reaction inside the brain, therefore it's a sensation. Not to be taken quite as literally as we do take them. So that's what he deals with. Mainly he deals with the material form. Because our next fella, Ashobhaya, uses Hom, and he deals with the consciousness of material things. So, if we're having trouble interpreting the physical world around us, we can either call him Vairochena or Ashobhaya. Ratnasambhava uses Tram, and he deals in sensation. Sensation is limited to only three sensations. I love this. Sukha, dukkha, nasukha madukkha. Pleasure, non-pleasure, neither nor pleasure or displeasure. Apathy, neutrality. So this is where he deals. And this has a lot to do with with emotion. An emotion is a complex thought based upon a feeling. If I feel good about something, I get pleasure, like from this delicious tea. I like that. That is pleasurable. Now I'm going to have thoughts about it. Let's see. I really like that. It's strong. It's robust. It's good. It has got to be one of the most wonderful teas I've ever experienced in the world. It's warm. Warm like, well, you know, Mexico's kind of warm. And I like Mexico. Mexico is just the most wonderful place in the world to be in the wintertime. Wow, and that beach. Oh, and the food in Mexico. It's hot and spicy and wonderful. Ooh, talking about hot, spicy Mexicans, I wonder if Selma Hayek ever came out with another movie. Those are called papanchas. Proliferation of thought. And this is much what this fella deals with, that kind of proliferation of thought. So, or I can go the other way. I didn't like the tea. Oh, that is nasty stuff. It's bitter. It's horrible. I'm starting to make judgments about things based upon the sensation of good, bad, or indifferent. Does this sound fair to anybody? Our politicians make those kind of decisions. Certainly, we can be wiser. Amitabha. Padme is his symbol, Hri is his sound, and he deals with perception, or sanya. Perception is merely the ability to recognize patterns. That's it. We see a pattern, we recognize it. Now, our problem is we are inundated with patterns. We are getting billions and billions of bits of information at every second. 17 thought moments in the blink of an eye. Or as Zhi Yi, the founder of Tiantai, would say 3,000 worlds in a second, in a snap of a finger. We experience so much at one time. We can only bring in so much, or we get overwhelmed. If we actually could experience every bit of data that came into our heads, they would literally explode. So we have limited visual ability, limited hearing ability. Even a frog sees better than we do. They have a much bigger sense, sight sense. We can only feel certain things. We can't feel everything. We certainly can't smell everything. So what we can see, taste, smell, hear, touch, we have to recognize the patterns. And oddly enough, if we've never seen something before, we don't recognize it. We have to put it in terms of stuff we already know. So whenever we're having the experience, we're literally living in the past. Oh, I've seen something like that before. We're not living in the present where, I wonder what that is. We have to relate it to something we already know. There's an interesting story, I don't know whether it's apocryphal or not, I choose to believe it, that in 1492, Columbus came to New Espanol, better known as Haiti today, and he was docked off the coast of the land, and he couldn't, and the natives were out there, they'd never seen a big ship before, the ships were invisible to them. They couldn't see it. They knew that the water was acting strange, they knew that the seagulls were acting differently, they knew that the fish were acting differently, but they couldn't see anything out there. Eventually, their shaman watched and waited, probably did a little bit of zazen out there on the beach, some vipassana meditation or something, and noticed patterns forming, how the water was moving, what the birds were actually doing. And bit by bit, he could see these ships. The rest of the Indians couldn't. So he went by and touched him on the forehead, described what was out there. And once they understood the pattern, boom, they could see it. Supposed to be a true story, and I really do choose to believe that. They didn't have a pattern that fit what was going on, so they couldn't see it. How many patterns do we miss during the day because we don't know what's going on? Meditate. And Amoghasiddhi, he is the big, his vehicle is a mythical animal called a Garuda, sort of like a flying lizard, tiger sort of a thingy. And he deals with impulses, samskara. Now, when doing Virochana meditation, working with Virochana, it's best to have a mandala. This is his. When doing any kind of meditation or work with these individuals, it's best to have a mandala in front of you. In the good old days, when Buddhism was just getting started, they used to use plates called kasina. And they would stare into the kasina and practice jhana. They would not take their eyes off of it. And jhana, in a certain sense, means absorption. So their mind would absorb the plate as the plate absorbed their consciousness. This is a takeoff on that. It's a little bit more innate. There's Virochana in the middle. There are Buddhas around him. Looks like Amitabha. And down here somewhere on here is the patron that paid for this thing. But you stare into that long enough, reciting his mantra, you do go into a state of deep altered consciousness, one of the levels of jhana meditation. And that's how it's supposed to be. Virochana's endowments, his position on the mandala is in the center. His color is white. His particular Buddha family is Tathagata or Buddha. Tathagata is an interesting word. It comes from a word tatapa, which means reality. And it can mean one who has gone to reality or one who has come from reality. And in the past 20, 30 years, it's been popular to call Tathagata one who has gone to and returned from reality. That represents, this is what the Buddha, the historical Buddha, called himself. And he also used that when referring to a few of the arahats, the enlightened beings in his day. His mudra is the wheel turning, we talked about that, the wisdom of the Dharmadhatu, and then, okay. Tantric yoga class is karya, which has to do with ritual. So there's a lot of rituals involved with Virochana. Tantra yoga is probably really the most misunderstood and misinterpreted of all the paths of yoga. The reason why Tantra is so misunderstood was about 100 years ago, somebody came up with a great idea of what today we call Neo-Tantra. And Tantra got a bad rap, especially in India, Hindu versions of Tantra, because it was supposed to be all about sex. In Buddhism, there's, except for a few stray guys that use it for that, there's sex not involved in Tantra whatsoever. You can imagine it, but while you're meditating, it's not wise to do it. It really breaks your concentration. So we just don't do it. His pathway is that of the ritual. Some of the sadhanas, we have books called sadhanas. They're like prayer books and instruction at the same time. They have a little bit of the teaching. They tell you exactly what you're supposed to visualize, exactly what the mantra is and how many times you're supposed to recite it, exactly what meditation device you're supposed to use during the sadhana. Even to do a 10-page sadhana correctly would take 2 or 3 hours to do. A 5-page sadhana takes about 2 hours. It's a long process because part of that time using the sadhana, you are in sitting meditation, usually about 40 minutes. Maybe an hour, depending on how deeply you get into it. And they're very, very rigidly written, but they're also very poetic, very, a lot of symbolism. One of the weird things about the rituals, about Vajrayana in general, is, and Mahayana, you have to put it in the context of the original teachings, or else they make absolutely no sense. Anybody here ever read the Lotus Sutra? First time I read it, I thought I was reading sci-fi fantasy. It is so bizarre. You know, with all these Buddhas coming down from the sky and the lotus petals falling, stupas shooting out of the ground. It's fascinating, great stuff. It, based on Doctor Who or something. It's wonderful. Every time I read it, I feel like I should be playing the Doctor Who theme song before I open the book. If you get into Vajrayana, it sounds even more weird. You are transported to another world, another planet. Until you break the code and realize what they're talking about. What they're talking about is trying to get the individual practitioner to actually directly experience emptiness. In Mahayana, they love to call that emptiness. In Vajrayana, they're a little more honest about it. They're trying to get you to experience nirvana. Because without the nirvanic experience, there's no Buddhahood. You have to do that first. This is what creates the arahant, that experience of emptiness. The idea that I can have an experience, I can be in meditation, I can notice the sensations as they arise, exist, pass away, one by one, arising, existing, passing away, rising, existing, passing away. Concentrating at the same time on an object, like an imaginary Buddha that I'm creating in my mind, and noticing how that image changes even while I'm creating it. That's called dependent origination. Emptiness. That's the emptiness they're talking about. Once that is discovered, the consciousness slips further and further and further into the jhanas until a kind of nirvana can be experienced. Unfortunately, after we experience that, most of us get up off the cushion and go right back to what we were doing. If we were enlightened, we wouldn't do that. Okay, there we are. This is an interesting line. I wrote it myself, and I don't know what I was thinking. No, that's not true. Okay, in tantric practice, we experience the divine in everything we do. A reverential attitude is therefore cultivated, encouraging a ritualistic approach to life. That is to say that every space is a sacred space in this type of a ritual. What the thing that is probably strange in this line is the word divine. When we think of the word divine, we tend to think of a deity or a god, and that is divinity, that which partakes in divinity. Not always so much. In this case, divine is that which is separated from the mundane, is what it means in this case. Sitting down in front of a TV set, eating a bag of chips, realizing you can do that in a meditative way. There is an apocryphal story about Ajahn Chah, at least I think it's apocryphal, that some guy walks up to him, and a new monk, American, walks up to him and says, "May I meditate while I smoke?" He says, "Yes, yes, fine." Another guy says, "Oh, I want to smoke too. May I smoke while I meditate?" "No!" What's the difference? You can meditate doing anything. You can't do anything and meditate. So, that's what we mean by the divine in this case, meditating while you're doing anything. Okay, there are four classes of Tantra. Of course, I know it says the Buddha taught four classes of Tantra. The historical Buddha did not teach any classes of Tantra. That came much later. And it goes back to what do we mean by the word Buddha? In the Mahayana sense, and especially the Vajrayana sense, there was a belief. I take that back, not so much in the Vajrayana, more in the Mahayana. There was the belief that the Buddha did not actually die. That was an illusion for our benefit. And he actually went off to some place, some geographical location somewhere in outer space. And he's out there doing his Buddha thing now. And so he can talk to us and give us more literature and more instructions from where he's at. Okay, if you buy that, then the Buddha taught four classes of Tantra. If you don't buy that, then four classes of Tantra emerged and were classified by Tibetan Buddhism. And they did emerge, they emerged somewhere, some were written as early as the fourth and fifth century. They stopped producing them around the 13th century. I guess the Buddha stopped talking to us then. Okay, the four classes of Tantra. Action Tantra, which is Kriya, Performance Tantra, Charya, Yoga Tantra, and the highest yoga, Anuttara Yoga Tantra. They call that the highest yoga tantra because you're supposed to be able to get more realizations from that than you are from the other three. I sort of dispute that. I think it depends on who you are, what you're more geared to, because again, one size does not fit all. If you're more into the ritual aspects of tantra, then you'll do this one. If you're more into the changing your karma by through meditation and ritualized prayer, then that's your thing. If you're into straight meditation, that would be your thing. And if you're into the really extraordinarily complex visualizations, then that would be the thing. Here's the mudra for Vairochana. There's his hands in the Dharma wheel. And every one of these Buddhas have them. The seed syllable, everyone gets a seed syllable. It's right in his heart. You have to visualize it just to get the ritual started. Siddham script comes from India. This is a very ornate form of that. And this is the Tibetan form. And it's pronounced ah. And his standard mantra when you're doing the mala for a male, always in the right hand. If you're doing a female deity, always in the left hand, is Om Vairochana Hum. Om Vairochana Hum. Om Vairochana Hum. You say that for 2 hours, you will be having an altered state of consciousness. No doubt about it. His very simple mantra, it's just his name said in a ritual way. That's all. But he does have more complex mantras. In the Abhira mantra, which is used in Tendai Buddhism and Shingon and in Qigong in Japan, use the Mahavairochana, Maha, the great Vairochana. And they link him to the six elements. The five letters below, that would be these, represent the five material elements, space, earth, water, air, fire. And then Vairochana himself represents the sixth element, which is consciousness. Bonk. And they use the mantra of light, which is Om Amogha Vairochana Mahamudra Mani Padma Jvala Pravartaya Hum. And you notice that word right there, Mani Padma? most famous mantra in the world, Om Mani Padma Hum, from Avalokiteshvara. And it literally means unfailing, illuminating, great seal, jeweled lotus, blazing evolve, or evolution. This is his prajna. Asadhat Visvari. Her color is white. On her shoulder, she has the Dharma wheel. She's the prajna of Vairochana, and her name comes from Akasha. In Hinduism, that is a universal etheric field in which all past records, especially our karma, are recorded. People make a great deal of money looking into people's Akashic records. Of course, you have no way of verifying what they're seeing is real, do you? But they make a great deal of money at it. In Buddhism, it's not that mysterious. It means space, expansion. And after all, this is a tantric exercise, so it has to do with expansion. Dhatu is the realm or sphere or substrata of anything. In this particular case, space. Isvari means the ruler, and so this name translates to the sovereign lady of the sphere of infinite space. Now, these are all tantras. Tantra itself means, you break it into two pieces. It comes from tattva, meaning reality, and tra, which is the base word for Sanskrit's word liberation. But it also means expansion and liberation, expanding the consciousness and the mind, going beyond the limits of the boundaries that we have set upon ourselves through our karma, through our past action, expanding it, going through that, and freeing ourselves from our attachments, our aversions, and our basic ignorance, the three engines that run samsaric life. So, these five Buddhas and their prajnas are all like interwoven together, because another word for tantra is weaving. A weaving is called a tantra. So they're woven into our lives as our life is also woven into them, making one complete whole picture. This is why these five Buddhas have become, wrong way, these five Buddhas are archetypes of wisdom, of the wise person. I hope that made sense. I had a lot of fun doing it.
I had a question about the word kasana. You said it was a plate. I may be pronouncing it wrong. I'm trying to remember the word kasana, a plate. Isn't that a casino?
Our word cosmos comes from that.
Okay. Was that's used as a meditation object? Aren't there supposed to be like 40 or so? And one of the most common one being the breath, or am I confusing that with something else?
No, those are the 40 objects of meditation. There were 10 kasina. Six were colored plates, if my memory serves. Another one was light, space.
Right. They were part of the objects of meditation. So breath wouldn't have been one of the
kasinas. No, breath actually comes down. Believe it or not, breath is number 33 on the list of 40. I had to research that to satisfy a friend of mine. And if you take the 10 death meditations out of there, the cemetery meditations, then it goes up to like 13 or something. But yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Live in the past because we experience something and we relate it to past knowledge, or however mm-hmm. you'd want to put it. You know, and I can understand that. Could you elaborate a little bit more how you said we only see what we project?
Okay. It works very, very rapidly. At the University of Wisconsin in Madison, they're actually doing research on this, as well as Boston General Hospital and MIT. Stanford University's also got it. Excuse me, I keep forgetting there's a microphone here, and I want to scratch something. What apparently occurs in the brain in something like 1/17 of a second, very near. We see a form, we recognize it, we slap a label on it, and then we form an intention. This is the first four of the five aggregates. And then we become conscious of making, of having that experience, whether it comes to the eye or the ear or whatever. We become conscious of it and we create, like, orchid. Well, if I'm seeing an orchid, then there must be somebody seeing it, so I'm creating a me at the same time I'm creating an orchid. Divorcing myself or trying to separate myself from my experience of the orchid. Or trying to separate myself from my experience of the orchid. Well, it doesn't work that way. I'm part of the experience I'm having, no matter how many times I try to divorce myself from it. I'm still part of that experience. Well, what happens in the brain, as far as these folks are concerned, or what they have so far demonstrated, is that we have already, through our past experiences, come to expect a certain normalcy in our lives and our experiences. So in that 1/17 of a second, no matter what's going on, we've already reached back, formed that expectation, and then projected it outward and saying, this is what it is. And it doesn't have to be that. It could be something else. And this is how cognitive therapy also works, is that when we understand that we have that we're projecting onto the world our own expectations through language, let's change the language that we're using and then alter our expectations and what it is that we're experiencing, which is the very foundation of Nagarjuna's work in the second century when he wrote the verses on emptiness. So, and we do it all the time. Say if I have an argument with my wife, one morning, and she's gone through, which is probably pretty normal, she goes through the day and she's making changes, and by the time I get home, she's in a really, really good mood and she's all affectionate and everything. Well, in my head, she's still the ogre I left in the morning. That's another way we project our past onto the present. So when I greet her at the door, and she says, "Oh, hi, I love you, I missed you," and I'm immediately wondering, what does she want? and that's how that works. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
They used the word poly at the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Poly is a dialect of Prakrit, so is Sanskrit. They're related languages, but they're dialects, different dialects. Then if you can read Pali, you can probably read Sanskrit. If you read Sanskrit, you can probably read Pali. They're very, very close, but they're very different dialects. Pali actually, can't remember what it literally means, but it's kind of coincidental to me that Siddhartha Gautama was born in what we today call Nepal, and his earliest stuff was written in a language called Pali. That's an interesting coincidence. Don't know that it means anything, but it's kind of a cool coincidence. Yeah, it's a language that was put into writing, and the writing, the sentence structure and everything was made specifically for the Buddha's teachings. And they eventually became the original four Nikayas. And then over the course of another 200 years, they added everything else to it.
Could you explain a little bit more about the five schools and how they came about?
Originally, for about right after the Buddha died, like within a month, they gathered together, according to legend, 500 monks that recited the canon as they understood it. And originally there were just the four Nikayas. The later on a fifth one was added. This was pretty cool. Everybody was happy about it. And then roughly 100 years later, there was a second council that came together and there was a split. at that point between the Tariyas, who are today called Theravadins, that would be these guys, who actually formed as a monastic group under that name right around 330, somewhere in there, BC. And anyway, it was called the Mahasanghika. It was a movement of, they were actually more conservative than the elders were at this time. And the whole argument that they came out with, it was because when the Buddha died, he said that you could change some of the rules in the Vinaya, the rules of the monastery and monks. And you could change some of the minor rules. And he told this to Ananda. Well, Ananda was broken up. He was his youngest cousin, his best friend. He'd been the Buddha's servant for so many years. He was so broken up about this, he went back and he sat down and he cried, you know, very heartbroken. And he forgot to ask which minor rules they could change. So they couldn't change any. And then at the second council, this Mahasanghika came up and said, we're not changing any rules. And the elders wanted to change a few of them. And then, but we have two different accounts of it. We actually have the Mahasanghika's records of that council, and we have the Theravadin record of the council. And it's kind of interesting. Anyway, Mahasanghika died out almost immediately thereafter. But in its place came a less conservative school of Buddhism that eventually became known as the Mahayana. That's these guys. And they were very liberal in the sense that they were more lay-oriented than monastic orientation, although a lot of them were monastics. They were interested in expanding the literature because they thought that there were easier ways to teach Buddhism than just by going by the Pali Canon. So they started writing their own canon in Sanskrit. They preferred Sanskrit. They were northern Indians. They lived in Afghanistan, Persia. They were along the Silk Route. They talked to all these other religions that were up there, Zoroastrianism, Greeks. The Greeks were there, thanks to Alexander. And they were they started incorporating other ideas into the teaching and writing their own scripture. Well, eventually, by about the year 100 Common Era, they were almost died out. The Mahayana just did not get off the ground originally. And then came Nagarjuna. He wrote his 60 verses on emptiness, or 60 middle way verses. And then he wrote some other middle way verses. And what happened at that point was Mahayana got a shot in the arm. They started using Nagarjuna's teachings, which were strictly based upon the original canon. He didn't deviate one word. He just taught it in a different way. And that kind of a teaching gave Mahayana impetus to grow. And that was about, by the time they started growing as a group, it was about, I guess by the year 300, they were firmly entrenched just because of Nagarjuna. And then about 400 years later, pops up Vajrayana. Zen was founded by a semi-mythical character named Bodhidharma. They had to create a history for him because nobody actually knew where he came from, except that he was Indian. There's a legend that he cut off his eyelids because he kept falling asleep during meditation. And when they fell, tea plants came up. It explained the importance of meditation on one hand, and also explained where tea came from. How it got to China. Anyway, he went to China and he founded the Zen school based upon Dhyana, the meditation. And today Zen is very, very different than what it was originally meant to be. Originally, it was the practice of the four jhanas, jhanic meditation, during Bodhidharma's lifetime. And then now it's a very shorthand version of that practice, where you just sit, face the wall, at least Soto Zen, you face the wall, and Rinzai Zen, you face each other. And you just sit and feel your sensations until they drop off. And then body and mind are supposed to drop off, and then you enter into nirvana. And so those are the differences. Now, about the year 600, comes a Chinese fellow named Zhi Yi. He went to a mountain called Tiantai, which is the heavenly terrace, and he creates a system of Buddhism called Tiantai, which in Japan today is called Tendai. And he said, this is all nonsense. He said, you know, Hinayana, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, whatever yana, it's all good. It's going to take you to the same place, depending on how you practice it. And he opted for an idea called Buddhayana, where everybody's studying to trying to become a Buddha. Doesn't matter which one of these categories you fall into, the end result's got to be the same. You have to become fully enlightened. And what he meant by Buddha is indistinguishable from the Arahant. It was just different paths to the same thing. So he was happy teaching all of that.
What school would be associated with the Dalai Lama?
Oh, the Dalai Lama is Gelugpa Tibetan Vajrayana, Tibetan style Vajrayana. And it's interesting, when we talk about Vajrayana, everybody immediately thinks of Tibet because of the Dalai Lama. Tibet only represents about 12 to 14% of the entire Vajrayana population. Let's not forget, China recently became an officially a Buddhist nation, as did Mongolia. And Vajrayana is the dominant practice there. Actually, in China, they don't make these distinctions anyway. Buddhism is Buddhism.
There's a question through the internet.
Oh, I forgot we were being spied on.
Could you explain emptiness?
Yes, I can. And I'm one of the few that can. Where's the camera? Right there. Okay. This cup is empty of a tea bag. Now it's tea bags back. Emptiness is the idea that, well, first of all, to be empty, you have to be empty of something. And in all Buddhist teachings, as far as I know, the emptiness that we talk about is emptiness of a self. It's called either anatta, if I'm referring to me, or you. And it's called shunyata, if I'm referring to things. Well, lately, well, over the past 50 years, these distinctions between anatta and shunyata have been disappearing, so it's pretty much one idea. The idea is that anything that exists is empty of inherent, autonomous self-existence. In other words, nothing in the universe arose in a vacuum. Everything is dependent upon everything else. In order for me to be standing here talking with you, a lot of conditions had to be met. Almost an infinite number of conditions had to be met, of which I will just enumerate a few. I did not just pop up here all by myself. I am empty of popping upness. Okay, I had to be invited. I had to submit a proposal first, then I got invited. I had to have a track record. I had to have a car. I had to have a highway to drive on. I had to have gasoline in the car. Somebody had to make the car. Somebody had to pay for the car. Somebody had to drive the car. Somebody had to make the tires. I had to eat. I had to drink water. Oh yeah, did I mention the fact that I had to be born just to get here? then if I was born, then I had to have parents. They were born too. They had parents. Somebody fed all of us. I mean, there were farmers, and these farmers had parents. And they had to eat and drink water. There had to be ground to walk on, or else the highway wouldn't be out there. And the food wouldn't grow. There had to be rain, or the food wouldn't grow, and they couldn't mix the cement that they used on the highway. So emptiness basically says nothing happens by itself. There is no first cause of anything, because this process has been going on for an infinity. We don't need a first cause. You couldn't find one anyway. Because no matter how far back we can go, there's always interconnectedness of stuff. And that's the physical level. On the psychological level, emptiness has to do with the, if you've ever seen the samsaric wheel, it's got the little three animals in the middle, the pig, the snake, the rooster, and then around it, it's got the six realms, and then there are 12 pictures around the end, outside. That indicates emptiness of the mind, that there is a process of how we come up with thinking, how we actually come up with being who we are at any given moment. Now, emptiness doesn't mean we don't exist. Obviously, we do. There's a podium here. If I hit myself in the head, it hurts. So I'll stop doing that. I'm obviously here. You're obviously there. You're not just a hallucination I'm having. So obviously we exist. But the me that exists at this very moment is different than the me that existed in the car driving through to here through rush hour traffic. I was a much different person then. Since then, my mind has changed slightly. It's not the same as the Mui that was driving in rush hour traffic, but it's not all that different. And when I get home, I will be a different Mui. As a matter of fact, while I was talking tonight for that 1 hour, and I timed it, so I was under an hour, I probably went through 100 lives, 100 changes. And every time there's a change of mind, there is a birth, a lifespan, and a death. Then there's another birth, a lifespan, and a death. The Buddha talked about bhava, becoming. Or bhavana, excuse me. Becoming. He didn't talk about reincarnation. You'll find that nowhere in the scriptures, the original scriptures. As a matter of fact, you won't even find the term rebirth. But it's a constant becoming. We call that a rebirth. While I was talking, there were at least 100 rebirths of Mui. Especially when you didn't laugh at my jokes. And when I die and my mind and body separate, there will be another birth. Not quite the same as this Mui, but not quite different than this Mui. Not altogether different. And it's just a change of mind. And every change of mind is a new life. And how the mind changes is totally dependent upon our karma, our intentions, our motivations, what we're attached to, what we're pushing away, and emptiness. Because of emptiness, we change. We have no choice. When you get home, grab a bicycle, go down a hill, and notice all the changes that are going on in that bicycle. Now, at the bottom of the hill, have a little kid there with an iron bar. As soon as you get down to the bottom of the hill, the little kid sticks that iron bar into your tire, into your wheel, between the spokes. The wheel wraps around, the iron bar hits the bicycle, the wheel stops. What happens? The wheel stops, you stop later. Everything has to be in motion. Nothing can be immovable, or the universe won't work. This is also a meaning behind emptiness, one of the teachings behind it. Very, very interesting subject. Again, we could be here another 2 weeks talking just about that. And there'd still be questions. Very, very intricate. How do you reach emptiness? How do you actually experience it? One way. Oh, different religion, I'm sorry. Meditation. That's the only way actually to get into touch with it. The thinking process has to be subdued to the point where there is just sensation. And those sensations eventually die off too. Then perception doesn't quite leave, but it's not quite there. And then comes this beautiful thing that happens in the fourth jhana, where emptiness is actually perceived. And if you ever witness that, ever have that incredible experience, your life is not the same. People start complaining at you because, well, you don't think like I'd think. Well, of course not, because you've experienced something weird, something that you would never have imagined until it actually happened. See reality exactly as it is. It's like a spring in the brain that was wound up too tightly finally got loose and just whew, expansion and liberation.